It's now time for the Fantasy 411 podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fantasy 411. I'm Matthew Leach, talking fantasy baseball with MLB.com's lead fantasy writer, Fred Zinke. We've got a lot to talk about today, plenty of news. We are going to continue our position preview series with shortstop, and then Fred is going to talk with Scott Pianowski of our partner Yahoo Sports Fantasy. So a lot to get to. We're going to get rolling, and we're going to start with J.D. Martinez, which is another of these. There's a real challenge with spring training injuries for fantasy players, and that is unless it's something really cut and dried, unless you know we're talking about a pitcher who's going to get surgery, that kind of thing. There's really no need for clubs to say a whole lot about time frame. They're hoping to get a guy back. They're hoping to have him opening day. And really, as far as the club's concerned, the guy's ready opening day. That's all that ultimately matters all that much. So you kind of get these situations like we have with J.D. Martinez, where when you read between the lines, it seems pretty significant, but we're really not getting a whole lot of detail as to time frame. They're calling it a midfoot sprain. That certainly is a painful thing to deal with. Anytime you talk about hitters' feet, it's another one of those areas that can be pretty significant. Balance, weight transfer, all that kind of thing. You look at a guy like Albert Pujols and what plantar fasciitis has done to him, which is in a similar area. So the question is, for people who are drafting imminently, and I think there are a lot of people drafting this weekend, a lot of people drafting next weekend, we still don't know what's up with J.D. Martinez. How much do you ding him in your draft list for an injury that might be, he might play opening day, and, you know, it also wouldn't shock anybody, I think, if it was another month.
Yeah, I think you have to get a discount. I mean, you cannot pay full price if you're drafting for him this weekend, whether it's auction or draft. You know, I felt like he was maybe about a nice fourth-round pick in drafts prior to this injury. I think now I would probably drop him to about round seven or so. I think I would, you know, if I'm taking someone around four or five, I want them to be healthy right now, or I'd want them to be a first or second round type talent who had an injury. I think you have to get that amount of maybe about a three-round drop, or if it was an auction, I'd want a good $5 to $7 discount. Bill, I'm going to guess. I don't know. It's been a really weird injury where they just haven't said too much about it, and he's been had more tests and more tests and more tests. I think I want to just expect the DL stint and then hope I'm pleasantly surprised if I draft him.
Here's my question on J.D. Martinez. So I was looking at his games played, and, you know, you look at the totals, and it looks like maybe this is a guy who's been injury-prone. He hasn't really. He missed significant chunks in 13 and 16, but mostly it's just that until a couple of years ago, he wasn't a full-time player. But that leads me to a second question, which is, even if he's not injury-prone, he's only played 150 games one time, and we get to this point, and I just feel like maybe should you wonder with this guy, not is he injury-prone, but just we don't have a lot of evidence that says that he can hold up every day over 6 months. So I kind of wonder, should we have been thinking a little bit about that in the first place with a guy like him?
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, I think you described it perfectly. We can't really know with these late bloomers like Martinez who have low games played totals earlier in their career because they just haven't played well enough to get a full-time role. So it's hard to say. I mean, he's someone who will turn 30 during this season. And as you said, he's only been over 125 games once in his career, but some of that was due to performance. So I think he's not Giancarlo Stanton as far as injury concerns,
right,
but he's also not someone who we can consider durable yet. I really like his skill set overall. Like, I thought he was a really nice fourth-round pick before this injury as far as he hits the ball hard consistently. And those players, you know, can hit for average and they can hit for power. And I think he can still be that. It just, I have to expect a DL stint now.
Yeah, and I guess that's the thing. It's a little like when we talk about a pitcher, we talk about a pitcher who's maybe in his mid to late 20s and a guy who's never held up, and we say, well, look, we just don't know. This guy's never made 30 starts before. We don't know how he'll hold up. And I just wonder kind of philosophically, should we apply a little more of that thinking to hitters? if we don't know a guy can hold up over 6 months, do you need to bake that in a little bit? I don't know that it needs to be an extreme thing. Just something that occurred to me that maybe we should think about a little more with hitters as well as with pitchers.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he has that 158-game season 2 years ago in his back pocket now where he can say, okay, I can do it. But, yeah, on a consistent basis, can he be that guy who plays? I mean, you don't need 158 as a fantasy owner. What you'd like is the 145 or more year in, year out.
Yep. We move to the Nationals closer situation, something we have talked a lot about, not just this offseason, but it feels like, you know, that might be, aside from Bryce Harper, our number one recurring topic since you and I have been doing this, is what are the Nationals doing in the ninth inning. And it remains interesting. Recently, last few days, Cody Glover, who is a guy they've really liked his minor league performance, a pretty exciting pitcher, a guy who's got real good stuff, has started getting talked about as at least not eliminated from this competition. I'm still not entirely buying it. As has been pointed out, he hasn't really seen big league competition this spring, whereas some of his contenders for that spot have. I'm still going with Sean Kelly, but the longer this goes without them saying Sean Kelly is the guy, the more I am hesitant to treat Sean Kelly as the prohibitive favorite. And also... it makes me a little skeptical, even if he gets named the guy. The fact that they have gone to such great lengths trying to see what their alternatives are makes me a little nervous that even if they named Kelly the guy, he might have a short leash. They might be looking for alternatives in season. I really like Kelly, but it just makes me nervous to really put a whole lot of faith in him, even if he gets named the guy. Where are you at on Kelly right now?
Yeah, I can draw a comparison. A team that you and I have talked about a lot over time is the Marlins with A.J. Ramos, and how we both get the sense that maybe they just don't, he's their closer, but they don't really feel great about them being their closer, and they keep looking at other options. I'm with you with this stuff with Kelly. I mean, when I look at Kelly's numbers, he looks like one of the better relievers in baseball. Forget on the Nationals. He's been a really, really good reliever the past two seasons, and as a veteran, and this looks like a complete automatic that he becomes their closer. But why are we on March 23rd still talking about him not being their closer? I mean, it becomes kind of obvious after a while that his manager just doesn't really view him that way. So maybe he gets the job anyways, but I feel like Glover has a real chance now. I mean, they were talking about how he's been pitching the ninth inning in these spring training games, which is a little wonky because the ninth inning of these games isn't stressful, and the competition's usually watered down by then, so it's an odd way to audition him. But none of that really matters. What we're trying to figure out is what's in Dusty Baker's mind and what's he planning on doing. I still think Kelly is the best candidate. He's the one who I would draft first, but I've knocked him way down in my own personal rankings and in our rankings on MLB.com because it just seems like for some reason he hasn't caught his manager's attention, and I'm not sure what else he needs to do because his numbers from the last 2 years were terrific.
I think one thing to remember when you're dealing with Dusty Baker is he is kind of he is definitely an old school guy, and this was something that as spring goes on, Tony La Russa would do sometimes. He's fully aware that it's not the same competition. You're not seeing big leaguers in the ninth, but sometimes a manager really does just want to see. Guys still want to win a spring training game, and so a manager still wants to see how particularly a young pitcher handles pitching the ninth inning with a lead with a major league uniform on. I'm not with him on that, personally. I doubt you are either. But I do think it's indicative of something. I'm with you on Kelly. The other thing that all of this brings up for me is that Glover is now definitely a guy that I would think about stashing in a deeper league. He's got the skills to get a ton of strikeouts, even if he's not closing, so he's somebody who could have some value for you, even if not. But I also definitely get the impression that he's now the next guy in line. He's the guy who, if they don't bring somebody in and it blows up with Kelly, that's the guy it looks like swoops in and gets some saves during the season. And for me, that suddenly makes him a pretty intriguing guy. Do you like Glover as that kind of guy, or do you need to hear he's going to get saves?
Yes, well, actually, the way that I would approach this, and what I really like about this situation, a couple things. First of all, Kelly and Glover are both good pitchers. That was something I was going to mention, too, that Glover's minor league stats are really good. So they're both good pitchers. Either one of them, if they were the closer of the Nats, would be very valuable. And the Nats are a good team, which means they can provide, you know, a 40-save closer if someone can hold that job for the whole season. It would be really interesting this weekend in some drafts, while it's still unsettled, to wait until round, say, 20 or 21. By that time, all the solid closers are gone. Probably no one wants to touch Kelly or Glover, and if they're still sitting there, grab both of them with back-to-back picks, knowing that by mid to late April, and maybe even before that, but at least mid to late April, you'll hold them both. And then by then, if one of them is the closer and has been playing well, you just release the other one. And all of a sudden, you have someone who had the value of maybe even a top 10 or top 12 round pick on your roster from round 21 or 22. Yep. And the other pick, in quotes, was a bust. But, I mean, overall, the value from those two picks is really good.
Right. So, you know, I think the question becomes there, would you trade it before draft? You could trade your picks. Would you trade a 21 and a 22 for an 11? I think the answer is yes.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I love that these are good pitchers on a good team. You're not fishing for the Phillies closer or fishing you know, the Twins closer, a team that's not expected to win, you know, 90 games this year.
Staying in the NL East, the reactions after Matt Harvey's last start were much different. And I don't know. Look, one of the things you'll see sometimes when a star is struggling in spring is after about the third or fourth one, there's sort of this, well, there was something to like there, right? And I'm not saying people are making that up, but I just think that becomes a natural trait. I didn't see anything more than a couple of clips of it, so I can't tell you how he looked, but the reaction was, yeah, I know the results were bad, but this was encouraging. The results still weren't good, though. But Matt Harvey's velocity is ticking up a little bit, and as I think Anthony DiComo from MLB.com recently posted, you can pitch at in the big leagues at what Matt Harvey is currently hitting. He's sitting 94 and maybe touching 95, 96. You can absolutely pitch in the big leagues. And let's remember, he had plus breaking stuff. So it's not like he's defenseless out there. I'm kind of optimistic on Harvey, and I think where I am on Harvey right now is I really hope everybody else is down on him, because if he slips a long way, you better believe I'm going to snatch him up while the results are still bad and while there's still all this worry about his velocity. I kind of like the idea of stealing him late. You know, there'll probably be most leagues somebody where they're more excited about him, but are you worried more about Harvey now, less, about the same as you've been throughout the spring?
I'd say I'm more worried. I was a little more optimistic on him before spring training. He has been, like, overall not great in spring training, but you're right, he's kind of trending in the right direction. I don't know. I'm worried because there's still injury risk there, and then there's performance risk. Is he someone who, if you drafted him, so they, for example, their first series of the season is against the Braves. He would be a lock. I'm assuming you'd put him in your starting lineup for that series. Like if you had drafted him?
I kind of like the – I guess what I'm talking about with Harvey is if people are just so hands-off, because I did an auction draft where a few days ago where the final value on Harvey went pretty high, but like two-thirds of the people in the chatter about it were just like, I'm not touching this guy. I'm not touching him at all. And so if you find a league where that number is, you know, 9 out of 10 rather than 6 or 7 out of 10, I think there are some places where he's going to fall a long way, and that's where I'd really like to get him. So I guess after I was just so sanguine about him, I'm now saying, well, slow down there. I'm not sure it's an automatic, because I think if I'm drafting Harvey, I'm drafting him with the acknowledgement that he still may be slow to get going. We still may be looking at, you know, maybe even another month. I'm willing to do that if I get him at a certain place or at a certain price to say, this guy's coming back from something very significant, and I like what he's going to do over the course of the season. I think he's going to be better in May than in April, better in June than in May. It's a very long way of saying, I'm not sure I'd start him at the beginning against the Braves, but I think I would draft him even with that acknowledgement.
Yeah, and I think that's probably what owners are wrestling with right now is, can you pick him as a number three or even number four starter, knowing or feeling like maybe you don't want to start him right away. When I look at the ADP, if you're hoping he'll fall a little bit, some of the pitchers who have been going on average about 20 to 30 spots later than him include John Lackey, James Paxton, Julio Urias, Sean Manaea, Matt Moore, John Gray. So that's kind of the group where if he falls in your draft, so 20 or 30 picks, him falling about two more rounds from what his ADP is, which is around 150th, so around, say, round 12 or so in a 12-team league, around 13 or so, if he falls a little bit, I think then the decision for you would be, you know, do you like him better than the Paxtons, the Urias, the Matt Moore, the John Gray, or would you rather take one of them?
Well, I like Moore a lot, so that's a guy that I'm very intrigued by. You know, as somebody we've talked about, I just really like that combination. But I would take Harvey in a heartbeat over Gray. I think the upside, and I think the 2017 upside on Harvey versus Gray. And when you're at that point, I think what you're really looking to me, what you're looking at with those kinds of guys, is less who's more likely to hit it and more who's more likely to really give you something special. If you're talking that class of guys, I think you're way more likely to be excited to have Harvey in the second half than you are to have, for example, to have Gray, for example.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, I mean, some of the pitchers who are going right around him include Jameson Taillon, Stephen Matz, Lance McCullers. And they're similar to Harvey in the, yep. the way that they could be injured or probably effective but could be injured. Harvey could be, you know, ineffective. We'll see. But, I mean, those are all kind of high-risk, high-reward guys.
Yep. Yeah, and I, by the way, also from that group, I like Matz quite a bit.
Yeah.
Pretty encouraged.
Do you view Matz, I know this is a little off topic now, but do you view Matz as a bigger injury risk than, like, Harvey DeGrom? Like, that whole rotation is kind of an injury risk. Now, do you view Matz as the biggest injury risk or not so much? Because he seems to always have something, but he hasn't, had the huge thing.
I think he's maybe the guy least likely to make 33 starts, but I don't know that he's the guy most likely to be under 20, if that makes sense. I get the impression that he's a little bit like Tanaka's been in some years, where you kind of bake in that you're probably not going to get 33, but I feel pretty good about 27 or 8.
Yeah, I feel the same way. So I end up projecting him to, you know, 165, maybe 170 innings. Just can't get him to that 185, 190, 200 innings that he need to be to get to be a number one or two starter in a mixed league. But I'm intrigued by him as well. I just can't drive him up my projections too high because I'm with you where I feel like he's a better than normal chance of to be one of the pitchers who has the oblique strain or the groin strain or something that causes him to miss five starts or something.
Yep. We don't talk a lot of Padres on here, understandably. Alex Dickerson's status is at least in question. That was a guy who at least had some appeal. So as you look at some of the alternatives there and look at some potential speed alternatives, some guys where you might get some cheap speed, is there somebody in that mix that you like more than you did two or three weeks ago?
I think this, for me, solidifies Travis Jankowski as a late-round speed source. I'm a little worried with Jankowski about his splits and whether he can play against left-handers, but I think this, for me, solidifies Jankowski to at least be able to get a really good chance to play against right-handers, and I think he could be a really cheap source of 35, maybe even 37, something like that, steals. I think he's a bit of a one-category guy, but late, if you have a really powerful lineup, I think he's an interesting late-round pick.
Relative to some other guys in that kind of class, how much do you like him, and how much are you sort of scared off by the fact that, you know, last year he was almost a guy that you could kind of knock the bat out of his hands? Does he even with the speed, is he able to hit enough to continue to get regular playing time?
I'm not sure. I think he is against right-handers. I view him and Jarrod Dyson as pretty similar draft.
That's why I asked, yeah.
I think maybe just by a little bit rather have Dyson because he's in a better lineup. I think much better lineup. So I would rather have Dyson. But it may come down to for both of them is which one could hit 270 as opposed to hitting 230. And that does two things. It keeps them in the lineup, and it might keep them near the top of the lineup where they can score runs. So I think I think of Jankowski as someone kind of who, if you miss out on, you know, all your speed sources, and you're thinking late rounds, like, oh, I got to, other than working the waiver wire, I need to start with someone. Then I think maybe he's your guy. But overall, as you said, we talked about the Padres rarely. Like, I have very low optimism for all of that Padres lineup, just because as a group, I just don't think they can be very productive.
Didi Gregorius, how much are you knocking him down at a deep position? And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But at a deep position, with a pretty significant injury, how far are you knocking him down?
Yeah, he's for me in mixed league drafts, he's totally off my list. I wasn't really high on Gregorius in comparison to other people prior to his injury. I felt like just looking at some of his Statcast data, I felt like he was a regression candidate for this season. He was really fortunate to hit the home runs he hit last year with his average fly ball distance. And I know it's a hitter-friendly park, but even considering that, so. I was kind of low on him and felt like he was a low-end mixed league player in the first place. So for me now, there's just not enough upside there because he's not a 300 hitter. He's not a base stealer to me, I'm not interested in him at all in a mixed league. Are you any more optimistic than me that when he gets back, that it's worth stashing him for a month?
It's hard to see how, just because, again, it's such a deep position, and he's you know, he's shown a lot of things at various times, but he's never really kind of put it together to be special. I'm kind of willing to take my chances without him.
Yeah.
We have one last news piece. It appears that Jarrett Parker is going to be your left fielder for the Giants. 205 big league plate appearances, 11 home runs, 267 average, 33 runs. That's, you know, that's a real small sample size, but it's also some really nice numbers. And the Giants just seem to be, you know, a little bit like the Cardinals, one of those organizations where guys show up and they're ready to play. Guys who make the Giants are ready to be big leaguers. And, you know, this guy who had put up a nice year, his last full year in the PCL, he has consistently hit for power in the minors. I like Parker. How high do you have him? Is he a mixed league guy?
I think 10-team league, no. 12-team league, no. But I think 15-team league, yes. I think he's a late-round 15-team league guy. And I think in a 12-team league, he's someone you definitely keep your eye on if you don't have room for him on your bench to see how he starts the season. As you mentioned, his numbers in brief major league action are good. His numbers in the minors suggest that those major league numbers, although they're a little inflated by, you know, some good fortune on fly balls and batted balls in general, you know, that he really is a power hitter. That being said, I mean, San Francisco is not the best place to take a gamble on your power hitter. Man, if he was the Blue Jays left fielder to start the season and you knew he'd be playing half his games in that park and a bunch of games in Yankee Stadium and a bunch of games at Fenway and everything, it would be a lot more enticing. So that squashes some of my optimism, but this is definitely someone who could hit 25 home runs if he can hold the job all season, and that means, I think, in a 15-team league, you have to be interested.
We will move to shortstop in just a moment. Before we do, I want to take a moment to tell you about the StatCast podcast, a show dedicated to the analytics that drive the front office decisions in the modern game. It's hosted by Mike Petriello and Matt Myers, and last week they did a deep dive into hit probability and catch probability, two of the new StatCast metrics you'll be hearing a lot more about this season. You can download it on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts by searching for StatCast Podcast, or you can actually go to StatCastPodcast.com. We need one of those URLs, Fred.
Yeah.
Two things about the StatCast Podcast. One is, if you are a serious fantasy player, if you're a serious enough fantasy player that you are listening to us, then you almost certainly need StatCast in your life. Two, they're good. It's fun. I listened to the stat. I had a flight from Indiana to back here in Atlanta yesterday, and about half that flight, I was listening to the StatCast podcast. It's good stuff. It's a good listen, and it's interesting, and it is worth your time.
Yeah, I'd like to say to those who are listening to us right now that, you know, I've seen the growth of StatCast data as far as off-season analysis. Like, I've seen it a lot this winter and spring, talking about stats from last season. I really want to encourage owners to stay with that podcast and with the StatCast data in season. I think too many times people use it, and then the new season starts, and then they just don't keep up with it, and then, you know, they fall back on the, like, well, this guy's got 5 home runs in his last 65 at-bats, and it's like, well, StatCast data could tell you maybe whether this is a guy who's really crushing the ball or whether this is someone who's been really fortunate. So, I mean, that stay with it throughout the season. I think that's so beneficial for it's StatCast, and it's a lot of other things we do in fantasy where, you know, the work you put into your draft prep, you should be putting the same work into your weekly, you know, waiver wire bids and trade offers and everything else.
We now move on to shortstop, which, as we talked briefly about, is just a ridiculously deep position right now, a real wave of just enormously talented young shortstops coming along. Tier 1, Corey Seager, Carlos Correa, Francisco Lindor. You know, a year ago at this time, we were talking about Carlos Correa. People were talking about Carlos Correa as potential top 10 overall kind of guy. He fell a little short of that, but still, 274, 2096, 13 steals. Seager, of course, was a serious candidate for National League Most Valuable Player, 26 homers, 308, 105 runs. And Lindor is one of those kind of across-the-board guys. But here's the thing, and this is kind of – Lindor's a really interesting guy because he's an enormously fun player to watch. He's got a really broad set of skills. But I wonder, he's got to take a step forward in something this year to me to be a really elite
kind of fantasy guy. He's got to either bump those 19 steals up, bump those 15 homers up, bump that 301, and he's capable of doing any of them. The question is, do you think he's capable of doing a couple of those and really taking that step up to that really top-of-the-draft kind of guy, or do you think he's more a really all-around, valuable, going to help you in a lot of ways kind of guy?
Yeah, I mean, there's a good chance he settles into the second part, but what I like Lindor more than most people do for this season, and what I like about him is, as you described, there are so many ways he could take a jump. You know, he's kind of settled himself in as a 300 hitter, and I think he can keep doing that, and there aren't that many of those these days.
Yep.
And as you said, like, maybe he takes a big power jump and becomes a 24 homer guy. I don't think that's happening this year, but it happens sometimes when we don't suspect. Maybe he does 28 steals this year, and that's his big jump. Or maybe it's just incremental gains, and he bumps the homer total 4 or 5 and the steals total 4 or 5, and hitting third in an Indians lineup that a lot of people like, right in front of Edwin Encarnacion, he scores 110 runs, or even 115 runs. I mean, Josh Donaldson has been scoring runs like crazy, not to say he's a Josh Donaldson-level hitter, but like crazy hitting, you know, in front of Encarnacion the past couple years. So I just think there's a lot of ways he can improve. I think the same thing with Correa. Like, he could become
right.
more of a base stealer. He could move his power from good to great. He could start to become, like, a really high RBI guy hitting in the heart of a lineup that I think is going to be much better this year. I like those two the best in Tier 1 for that reason, just that there's so many ways they could improve.
And the thing is, all of those guys are going into their age 23 season, so that's part of the challenge here in projecting them. I don't want to pour cold water on Lindor because, again, he's a fantastic player and a really valuable fantasy player. But I do worry a little. The reason he worries me a little bit, and I finally just put my finger on it as we're already into this conversation, is Bogarts. He has a speed aspect that Bogarts never had. I feel like we talk about him a little the same way we talked about Xander Bogarts, in that he does so many things well and all he's got to do is jump forward with one of them. Bogarts never is not fair. He's young, but haven't seen Bogarts turn that broad base into elite fantasy player. Again, I know the speed is a significant difference, but I really kind of want to see something of an elite fantasy skill before I put him in with somebody like a Correa who has shown, I think, a little more potential to be an elite fantasy player. Am I just being incredibly unfair, or do you think there's reason to have something in the back of your mind that Lindor may be merely an excellent player and a very good fantasy player?
No, I think that's fair. And I will also say that players with Lindor's type of skill set, and you rate a good comparison with Bogarts, they also do walk a fine line. When you're a 15-homer, 19-steal guy last season, I mean, it only takes a little regression to become an 11-homer, 15-steal guy, and that doesn't look very cool at all. And you didn't have a big drop in any one area. You just had little drops. I think of Lindor as a really high-floor guy because so far he's been really durable.
Sure.
If he's a 300 hitter who hits third for the Indians, as the speed and the power kind of fluctuate throughout the season, I think the floor is always really high because he'll be driving in and scoring runs.
And we move to Tier 2, speaking of Xander Bogarts, and it's, boy, it's three really different guys. Xander Bogarts, Trevor Story, Jonathan VR. A speed guy, a power guy, and a steady across-the-board does-everything guy. Is it already late enough when you're talking about these guys to be talking about fit for your team, or do you have a real clear order of, yeah, no, no matter what, I want one of these guys?
I think you can think about fit a little bit, although I've seen in drafts that I've been in, and not mock drafts, real playing-it-out drafts, I've seen this Tier 2 go in the middle of Tier 1 in a lot of drafts. I almost put them all together into one tier. I think that, like, I've seen VR go in the second round in a draft. I've seen Story go in the second round. In the Yahoo Friends and Family draft, Bogarts went at least before Seager and Lindor, and maybe even before Correa. But so, I mean, that Tier 2 is almost right in with the Tier 1. I think you're looking at those guys, though, more probably as third rounders in a lot of drafts. Now, at that point, you probably have one and maybe even two hitters. So you can start thinking, you know, did I go Arenado? Okay, now VR, or maybe Bogarts a bit, but more VR is a nice compliment. Or did I start Trey Turner and a pitcher? Okay, now Trevor Story is a really nice compliment. So I do think you can start to balance in maybe around round three with one of them.
Tier three is one guy. It's Jose Peraza, who is finally going to get his opportunity to play. He hit .324 and stole 21 bases in less than half a season last year. That's kind of intriguing. Can you double that, do you think? You like 40 steals from Peraza, and do you like him as a legitimate 300 hitter?
Yeah, I believe he can hit 300 or 295 or something along those lines. But he keeps the ball on the ground quite well, and I think that's even a young player who knows his skill set and knows, you know, I don't hit home runs, keep the ball on the ground, get on base, and go from there. For me, if he hits second in the lineup in front of Joey Votto, then I really like him as someone who could bat 300, steal 40 bases, and score 85, 90 runs. And not a great lineup, but a hitting in front of Votto is really nice. So, he kind of sits on his own. He's definitely not with the Tier 1 or 2 guys, but he is really exciting. And I do think Peraza could be, we've talked about him a little bit like early last season, I do think he could be kind of the poster boy for someone who's much more valuable in fantasy than he is to an actual baseball team.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And then we move to Tier 4, and we're still talking about some really good players here. Aledmys Diaz, Addison Russell, Elvis Andrews, Brad Miller, Troy Tulowitzki. The two guys I want to talk about here are Russell and Tulowitzki. And in some ways, actually had really similar numbers last year. 254, 24, 79 for Tulo, 238, 21, 95 for Russell. Obviously, you'd like Russell's chances to take a leap forward from that more, but I just really think it highlights something we've talked about a lot. You're talking about 20, 25 home run shortstops going and almost being behind people who have other guys.
No, you're right. This is how deep it is right now. I mean, you can take someone like Russell, who is a really nice power source last year and is clearly on the way up, as the 10th or 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th shortstop in a draft, like a mid-round type pick, which really shows how deep it is now. You can take someone like Tulowitzki, who's definitely not in his prime, but, you know, after about June last year was a really productive player and could easily, I mean, it wouldn't shock us if he went back towards the 30-homer mark at some point still in the future. I don't know if it will happen, but it could happen. And he barely made it into this list of the top 12 shortstops. So it's definitely a sign that even though the talent's so great in those top tiers, you don't have to get one of them, you know, to have a productive shortstop anymore.
All right, well, this is the part where I say thanks and goodbye. But we're not done yet, so stick around. Just a moment here, Fred is going to talk to Scott Pianowski of Yahoo Sports, Yahoo Fantasy, and they are going to talk a little more about shortstops. But for me, thanks everybody for listening, and thanks, Fred, for taking the time to talk.
Okay, everybody. So, as Matthew just said, really excited to have Scott Pianowski in here from Yahoo Sports. Scott, I'll be totally honest, one of my favorite guys in this industry, one of my favorite people to play in a league with, and I've played in a few with them. Scott, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Fred. Thanks for that wonderful intro. You probably like me so much because every time we make a trade, it ends up favoring your team at the end because, you're one of the best competitors I've ever played against and also one of my favorite people.
I do have a short memory on trades, so I actually can't – when I have a bad one, and I'm sure I've had some with you that didn't work out well. Now, I will say that right now I'm going to be friendly with Scott for everyone who's listening, but as soon as this phone call ends, I'm putting on my Tout Wars game face because we're about – 50 hours out from the start of the Tout Wars mixed auction, which is on Saturday. For people who want to follow along, both Scott and myself will be in it. The Tout Wars auctions will be going on all weekend. There'll be an AL only and an NL only on Saturday and Sunday morning, respectively. Ours is Saturday afternoon. People can follow it on the Tout Wars website. They can also, and there's a blog going on there during the auctions. They can listen to it on Sirius Fantasy Sports Radio. Scott, how are your preparations going? Without giving me any of your secrets or your plans, you know, how are your preparations going? Are you excited for the auction?
Oh, yeah, I'm always excited. The auction is at such a fast pace. Your head's a little bit of a blur during it, but you're matching wits with people who have been doing this for a really long time, and all the names that you know in fantasy are usually in either the Labor or the Tout Wars auctions or both of them, and I can't wait. I love drafting. I love anything tied to fantasy. I love DFS. I love all that stuff, but to me, the in-person auction is the ultimate in a fantasy experience because you have to think so quickly.
Now, and I, this wasn't something we were going to plan on talking about, but I think our listeners would enjoy hearing it a little bit. What do you do during an auction? Like, are you a spreadsheet? Do you keep track of everybody's bids on all the players? Do you project out your own team stats as you go through the auction? Or, how much do you get involved with? Because I'll say first, to tip my own hand, I'm just a one piece of paper guy. You know, I've kind of got prices, and I'm tracking what people are going for, but I'm not heavy on numbers once we're actually in the auction because, as you said, it's different than a draft. It goes really fast, and there's a lot to pay attention to. How much do you find you can take on during the auction process?
It's a great question. I think if people feel comfortable with just one piece of paper, I actually think that's a great way to go. What I've used the last couple of years is the RotoWire draft software, and I'll give those guys a plug. They do a great job with it because I'm comfortable doing – you have to do a moderate amount of data entry during the auction. And, again, at a pace of a Tout Wars auction, some people might find that intimidating, but I think I'm good enough with – I know my way around the software well enough that I don't find it cumbersome. But I think the key for anybody at a draft or an auction, especially if it's something that's at a quick pace – is you don't want to be burdened. You don't want to be the guy who's coming in with five resources who thinks he's going to look up stuff in a book and look up stuff in a magazine and then go to a website that's going to require a bunch of clicks to try to get information when you need to make a quick decision. That's probably not going to work for most people. It's one of those things that you think back to college or university where when you arrived the day of the test, you already had to have the work done. It already had to be in the back of your head somewhere, and then it was just a matter of recalling it and trusting that you knew the material. That's kind of the way I approach this stuff, that Muhammad Ali used to say that the battle was won far away from witnesses. And I feel that for fantasy, it's the same way. Not to make this too grandiose. I mean, it's a game, it's fun, and we're picking baseball players. I mean, we're not solving the problems of the world or anything. But I do think that your preparation has to be done before draft day or auction day, and you probably want to stay with as basic a setup on the day as possible, just so you don't get confused.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, when you're in a draft, it can be seven or eight picks away from you, and you start to narrow your options down to three mm-hmm. or four players, and then you decide to kind of just visit a couple sites and make sure they're healthy, or just look at the latest news update on them to make sure you didn't miss something, and you know, and you're just toggling back and forth between windows and everything. And I know most people do drafts, and I get that. I like drafts online and everything, but yeah, in the auction, you don't have time for that. Now, talking about drafts, I wanted to give you a chance, Scott, because the Yahoo Fantasy Baseball Drafts and Fantasy Baseball Leagues are the official, you know, leagues for MLB.com. Andy did it a couple weeks earlier when he was on, but for people who didn't hear that episode, you know, maybe talk to people about what are some of the features of Yahoo Leagues that make them a really good choice for hosting your league or for joining a league if you don't know where to go to join them, because I've always enjoyed that, and I said this when Andy was on, I've always enjoyed the user setup at your site, and I've played on every major site over the last 10 years, and I've always found my teams really easy to manage when my leagues run through Yahoo.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much. You know, I felt the same way that even before I started working for Yahoo, and it's almost 8 years now, that I usually would play my games there because I think their interface is the most attractive and it's the most intuitive. And what I mean by that is when you're trying to figure out how to navigate, how to pick free agents, how to do stack queries, the choices that they have and the way everything is laid out is in a very logical way that even if you don't know what you're doing, you'll figure out what you're doing really quickly. That's what I mean by intuitive. And they do an excellent job also of keeping your records. If you want to see, you know, what percentage of other fantasy baseball players have I finished ahead? What are all the leagues I've finished in first in over the last few years? Or I've finished, quote-unquote, in the money in or in the top three. And it's very easy to sort that out, see how you've done in different sports, what your best sports are. They'll give you achievement badges if you make trades or if you do certain things, just to make it fun. So I think the user experience at Yahoo is – I mean, because everybody basically has the same game, right? I mean, you know, you're going to play – fantasy baseball anywhere. I mean, it's not like anybody's giving you a different version of the game. We're basically doing the same thing. But I think the user experience, the way it looks, the way it navigates, the app is terrific, the design team. And these are all things I have nothing to do with, by the way. The fact that Yahoo has a great game has nothing to do with me. I'm just somebody who tries to help you play it a little bit better. But I think the user experience is far and away, because I would play anywhere I enjoyed, you know, and I've always found that Yahoo had, the best user experience.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. All right, let's talk shortstop a little bit. So Matthew and I went through our tiers at shortstop. We talked a little bit about tier one, which for us was Seager, Correa, and Lindor. And I wanted to call you out on something. So when we did the Yahoo Friends and Family draft a couple weeks ago, and I picked second and took Clayton Kershaw and felt pretty confident that I would take Francisco Lindor in round two. So that would have been pick 27. I think his ADP was, you know, late 20s. And he didn't even come close to me because I believe you took him early in round two ahead of Corey Seager. Now, on your rankings, you have Seager ahead. You took Lindor. Was that a team planning decision? Was it just a spreading out from maybe other drafts you've done decision? And is it indicative of just Matthew and I were talking about how narrow the gap is in that tier one and how maybe the names are a little bit interchangeable?
I think the last thing you said is certainly true. In fact, we did a piece at Yahoo that readers can go check out on Roto Arcade where we actually, four of us, ranked four different shortstops. We're trying to figure out who to pick between Correa, Bogarts, Lindor, and Seager. And the four of us, Andy, Dalton, Brandon, and I all picked a different shortstop, which I think underscores how close these guys are. And it's such an interesting group because they're all young. They're all, and these are guys, I mean, you saw last year, Seager was the Rookie of the Year in the National League. I mean, I think some of these guys are going to win MVPs. Or I think, did Lindor win a Gold Glove last year? If he didn't, he's going to win one very soon because he's an awfully talented defensive player. And wasn't it interesting to see him keeping the shortstop position in the World Baseball Classic, even though he was playing with Correa? Correa slid over to third base. But there's really no obvious right and wrong answer to this. And the reason why I took Lindor over Seager, and I actually would have taken Correa had he been available, but he went earlier in the second round, it's just that one of my rules of thumb is I do not like to draft into injured players unless I get, I think, a notable kind of coupon or discount for that. And I don't know that Seager's oblique is going to be a problem for any significant length of time. But when I'm looking at similar players, one player has, as far as I know, a clean bill of health, and one player is dinged up. That, to me, is a great way to break a tie. And I think with these four shortstops, you're kind of looking for things on the margins to break the ties because I don't think they're obvious things. So when I saw Seager not at full health, it pushed Lindor higher on my sheet.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. And Seager did go, you know, shortly afterwards. Okay, now we're going to go a little deeper on the shortstop list. In fact, deeper than – we'll start with some of the players that Matthew and I previously talked about, but then we'll get a little deeper to some that we didn't talk about that will still be on a lot of teams. And we're going to do this similar thing to what we did with Andy a couple weeks ago where I picked out from your ranking, Scott, a player who you have higher and then a player that we have higher in comparison to the two, and maybe you can just talk about why you had that one higher. So we have Aledmys Diaz ahead of Addison Russell. Matthew and I actually sung the virtues of Russell a little bit. You have Russell higher. Why do you prefer Russell to Diaz?
Although I do think the Cardinals have a great lineup, and it's going to be helped with Dexter Fowler at the top of that lineup. I think Chicago has the best lineup, the deepest lineup in the National League. And with Russell just having more of a pedigree, somebody who we've been waiting for a couple of years, where Diaz a little bit out of nowhere last year. I don't know what to do sometimes when a player like Diaz splashes and play so much better than we expect. I think sometimes they're difficult guys to judge the next season. So with Russell, I just feel like it's a safer pick because the pedigree is better, and I feel like the lineup, although St. Louis does have a good lineup, I think Chicago's lineup is a little bit deeper.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I think the floor on Russell is definitely higher than Diaz in the sense of if Diaz, I don't anticipate Diaz having a bad season at the plate, but if he did, I mean, we could look back and say, oh, well, I guess prior to 2016, there wasn't really much there, or so, you know, so I guess that's not totally shocking. Whereas if Russell had a really bad season, I think we would be really surprised.
To be fair, though, I mean, this also is going to be a very format-dependent question where you may be in some leagues where it makes more sense to swing for the fences, and if you think Diaz, if you want to trust what he did last year, and you say, the heck with four, I'll worry about four in the middle of the season, I'll pick up somebody else, I'll try to find the next Diaz if it doesn't work out. But there will be some leagues where you may be in a position where you want the player with a higher upside, and you certainly could make the case that maybe that's Diaz.
Yeah, that makes sense. And speaking of swing for the fences picks, we have Jose Peraza on our rankings very high, so mm-hmm. I'm pretty high on him. I talked with Matthew a little bit earlier about how I think he has the potential to hit 300 and steal 40 bases and score 85 or 90 runs, maybe not 90, maybe 85 runs. You have Troy Tulowitzki higher, which I can definitely see a rationale for. Are you buying Peraza, or is this you think Tulo still has like another 30 homer season in him, or is it maybe that you're not quite as sold on Peraza as I am?
I think it's a case of I like Peraza and you love Peraza, and
yeah,
maybe I need to make the adjustment between now and Saturday. I think he's a tremendous pick. His ADP in Yahoo, I think, is around 170, which I don't think is anywhere near where it should be. He qualifies at multiple positions. It sounds like they're going to let him run as much as he wants to. He'll probably bat near the top of the lineup. So I think he's a tremendous player. The thing with Tulowitzki that probably I get caught up in, and maybe too much, is that I always view picking Tulowitzki as Tulowitzki and whoever I'm going to replace him with for the month that he's hurt, because we know that Troy Tulowitzki in a full season, you're just not going to get that. But I thought last year he had a reasonable power output, shortstop in the middle infield. If you're replacing Tulowitzki, remember it may be with a second baseman if you have another shortstop on your roster. I feel like those positions are deeper now than they normally would be. And also in Yahoo, we have very low thresholds for qualification at positions. So I feel like if you have Tulowitzki and he does get hurt, you're probably going to have a lot of options. So maybe with the idea that I think there's a high replacement value in the middle infield, I think that may bump up Tulowitzki artificially on my board when maybe some people don't consider that angle.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And now we're going to go a little deeper, and we're going to compare Dansby Swanson, who we have a little higher on our list than newly contracted, now has a lot more money secure in his bank account in the future, Tim Anderson. You have Anderson higher than Swanson. I think I know what the reason is, but I would like to give you a chance to explain it to everyone. So why would you prefer Anderson over Swanson?
Yeah, I definitely like Swanson. Again, it's a case of a little bit dinged up this month. And I think the chance of Anderson having a blow-up season in steals is maybe more bankable than what Swanson might give us in the category juice with the home runs and the stolen bases. I love the way Swanson commanded the strike zone when he came up last year. I think he might hit for a plus average right away. And I also think that Atlanta can keep him near the top of the order. For National League players, we really want to focus on these guys hitting first and second as opposed to seventh or eighth a lot of times with the second baseman, the shortstops, the table setters. I think both these players will hit near the top of their lineup, so that's probably not a problem. But I just see the potential of maybe Anderson might be ready to steal 40 or 50 bases, where with Swanson, I think it may be like, well, maybe he'll hit 10 or 11 home runs. Maybe he'll steal 8, 10, 12 bases. I don't know that he's going to dominate in those categories, although I do like Swanson as a batting average player, and I think he's going to – I mean, how did Arizona ever let that guy go? I mean, Dave Stewart's going to rue that for the rest of his days. But I think Atlanta has a great player there. I just feel like the stolen bases with Anderson makes him more bankable, plus he's probably more healthy right now.
Yeah, and I mean, Swanson is that – in my eyes, Swanson's a – for where he's being drafted, probably a pretty high floor if he's hitting high in the lineup, but a pretty low ceiling for now. Whereas Anderson, and you mentioned it with the Peraza earlier, whereas Anderson could be that a little bit of a boomer bust pick. You know, he doesn't walk, so if he's not hitting, then he's not helping you at all. But if he does hit this year, there's the potential for that high stolen base total. And you mentioned him hitting high in the lineup. One thing I did want to mention in defense of Anderson, since he's not the one that was on our side of this little debate, is people are talking like the White Sox lineup is going to be way worse than it was last season, and because they're rebuilding. But when I actually step back and look at the moves they made in the rebuild, it was mostly about taking out their pitching. I mean, like the lineup, they lost Adam Eaton. But, I mean, other than that, Cabrera's still there, Frazier's still there, Abreu's still there, right? Anderson's still there. I'm not saying they're a good lineup. I'm just saying I don't see why they'll have Moncada at some point. I don't think the White Sox lineup is going to be that much worse than it was last year, do you?
Well, also, I think those are all great points. And also, even if they trade Frazier or Abreu, it's going to be after 4 months of the season.
That's right. It's
not going to be on April 17th, at least very highly unlikely. I mean, that would be a thing where they'd probably let the season play out and try to wait until teams are ready with teams have needs. And you know, those trades happen in the middle of the year or towards the end of the year. They don't happen. I can't remember the last time there was a major baseball trade in April or May, and it's just not the way it works. So even if we argue that they're going to have a different lineup at some point, that may be September, that may be August, and it's not going to be right now.
Yeah, for sure. And, if you're looking by the time Moncada's up, whether it's May, June, whatever, but if you're looking at, you know, Anderson, Moncada, Abreu, Frazier, Cabrera, like somewhere in that top five, I do think it's a top-heavy lineup, and the bottom of it isn't going to be good, and that's probably why the White Sox won't be great. But up at the top, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that group. So Anderson could certainly score runs if he can hit for average. Okay, the last one I wanted to do, we have Asdrubal Cabrera higher. You have Brandon Crawford higher. I will say that I am known for being the not Brandon Crawford guy, and I know that he's a really good, real major league player and a good defender. I've always been the low man on him for fantasy. So this is a chance. Stick up for your boy, Brandon Crawford.
I'm trying to get him for the defense, Fred. I want the best defense possible. Although we will say also, as much as defense doesn't really matter for fantasy, it does keep players in lineups. And, like Tim Anderson's contract will give him some floor because we know they're not going to bench him in Chicago. Brandon Crawford's never going to get benched because of his defense. It's a very, very small point. It's not really part of this argument. But when people say defense doesn't matter for fantasy, well, it matters a little bit. In the case of Crawford, I think the Giants lineup, I mean, we think of San Francisco and we think of that big park and we think of how it crushes offense and it crushes scoring and power. And those are all good, you know, reasonable things to think about. Crawford is still, I know everybody hates RBIs as a stat, but it's a fantasy stat. He's driven 84 runs the last 2 years. I think they actually have a pretty deep lineup in San Francisco. And I love the way he hangs in against lefties. You saw it last night in the World Baseball Classic. He doesn't have the same power against left-handed hitters, but he actually has about the same average against lefties. So I think he's playable against all different kinds of pitching. just a case of this Mets lineup I don't feel that good about. The Giants, I feel like if they can get Pence healthy, Posey last year played, and then you know because we made a trade with Posey. I mean, he played half a season with a busted thumb or a thumb that was really irritating him and taking out his power. I think Crawford's an underrated player. He's going to get you double-digit home runs. He'll steal a few bases. I think there's actually upside with his stolen bases because he's had such a high rate of success. And because he hangs in against lefties, I actually think there's a little bit of latent batting average upside with Crawford. Not that he's anything special. You can get him in Yahoo leagues outside the top 200. But I think he's a very playable utility middle, your third middle infielder. And I think the Giants' offense may be a little bit better than people realize.
Yeah, and I will say with Cabrera, I'm reasonably optimistic from him. But he was a little bit of one of the poster boys for last season's power explosion across baseball, where he kind of settled in as like a 15-homer guy, a 250, 260 guy, and then last year all of a sudden hit 280 with 23 homers and hadn't done anything like that since 2011. So if someone wants to project him to go back to 15 home runs and a 255 average this year, I can't really argue with that. I think maybe he can hold some of that power, but I can't really argue with it. Okay, well, we've been on now going for a while now, going back to when I started with Matthew. So, Scott, I'm going to let you get back to work, but not too much work because I don't want to give you too much time to prep for that auction on Saturday. So, in the words of Matthew, I want to say, to wrap up this week, thanks, Scott, for being here. For everyone who's listening, get out there and sign up for those Yahoo leagues. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks, Scott, for taking some time to talk.
Thanks for having me, guys.